Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Scotland, episode 23, The History of the Normans. A quick note, next month, which is August, I'll be going over and redoing the first and second episode of this series. This is a part of a larger project of me redoing the first 6 to 7 episodes of this podcast to improve on the script being told and the audio quality in general. I've been meaning to do it for a while now, and I think I've mentioned it quite a few times already, so I think it's best to commit to this and get this project started. This might mean, though, I'm only able to release 1 or 2 new episodes in August. I'm sorry, but it is a much-needed exercise that I need to do to help explain the early history of Scotland. This does mean you can actually all go give it a re-listen and take a trip back to a time full of Brythonic tribes, a Roman Empire enforcing its will on a small island called Britain, and them struggling to bring the north full of barbarians to heel, which results in a certain famous wall being built. I will of course keep you all updated, so stay tuned for more of these re-releases soon. Anyhow, last time, we went through Malcolm III through his middle years of kingship, as his court reforms took place, the Anglo-Saxon reforms that is, and his relationship with the English crown developed into a troubling rivalry of such. In our tale, he was last left in the north of England, raiding the countryside, and soon realised the land around him seemed very empty and eerie, and Queen Margaret ate tea in her castle in Edinburgh. She felt a great sense of dread and fear hit her, something that prevented her from sleeping. She felt a great storm was coming and was about to hit Scotland. Was this a warning of things to come, maybe, for Malcolm? Well, sadly, as I said, you'll have to wait till next week for the answer to that question, as today I want us to go over something entirely different. That is the history of the Normans. Now, yes, I am aware this is the history of Scotland and not the history of Normans or England. But in my defence, the Normans have already had a major impact on the country of Scotland at the time of our story. And with David I coming along soon, who actually makes changes to his court and the kingdom that will be based on the Norman Anglo style of living, I think it would be a good just to tell a brief, or rather a fast, history of the Normans. I also will have a recommendation for further listening at the end of this episode, so if you wish to learn more about Norman history, please do wait till the end. So, this episode, History of the Normans, and next week we can return to our tale. Sound good? Well, let us begin. The story of the Normans begins with a dream. Rollo, the chief of a small band of Viking adventurers, approaches Paris. A quote from a historian. Rollo seemed to behold himself placed on a mountain far higher than the highest in the Frankish dwelling, and on the summit of this mountain he saw a spring of sweet-smelling water flowing, and himself washing in it, and by it made him whole from the contagion of leprosy. And finally, while he was still staying on top of that mountain, he saw about the base of it many thousands of birds of different kinds and various colours, but with the red wings extended in such numbers, and so far and so wide that he could not catch the sight of where they ended, however hard he looked. And then went one after another in harmonious incoming flights, and sought the spring on the mountain, as the birds washed themselves, swimming together as they do when the rain is coming. And when they had all been anointed by this miraculous dipping, they all ate together in a suitable place, without being separated into species, and without any disagreement or dispute, as if they were friends sharing food. And they carried off twigs and worked rapidly to build nests, and furthermore, they willingly yielded to his command in the vision. Rollo took heed of the omens in the dream and founded a territory that became the Duchy of Normandy, uniting various groups under his lead. Later, chroniclers recounted how Rollo's descendants and those of his followers conquered and ruled the kingdoms in England and Sicily and led armies on crusade. Rollo himself is a bit of an enigma. Viking society in the 9th and 10th centuries was an oral culture, so the written sources that describe his origins were all written later, and for the most part by churchmen writing within the Frankish historical millennium. Similar to how our previous episodes, when we were trying to tell the Viking incursions in Scotland, it's very hard to recount history from a biased churchman source. Two traditions broadly emerged. One, led by Dudo, placed Rollo in Denmark. The other, based on a much later saga evidence, gave him a Norwegian background and the name Rolf or Harulf Gangr. These sagas are Orkneyed in the saga written at the turn of the 12th and 13th centuries, and Snorre Sturluson, a historical saga of the Norwegian kings composed in 1220. Regardless, this would place our Rollo among this significant group of people forced out of their homeland by the ambition and growing power of the Norwegian king, Harald Finnhair. Rolf's compatriots would go on to settle Iceland and establish Viking colonies elsewhere in York and the Scottish Isles. We'll stick with Rollo and not Rolf, but he was just one of the many Viking leaders who had been raiding the North Sea, including the coasts of Scotland, England, modern-day Belgium, and the Netherlands, and France for a century prior to the foundation of Normandy in 911 AD. The annals written close to the time of these raids show that rulers intentionally tried to resist the incursion of the Norsemen by force, and when that failed, they tried to buy them off or give them land to settle in the hope that they could resist future attacks. What is crucial to the story of the Normans and what marks them out as different is the fact that none of these settlements on mainland Europe were as long-lived as Normandy. This region survived as a principality within the Frankish and later French kingdom until 1204 AD when Philip II Augustus of France captured it from King John of England. Yes, that King John. The treaty offered Rollo and his men the French coastal lands along the English Channel between the River Epte and the Atlantic Ocean coast in exchange for their protection against further Viking incursions, as well as promising to protect the area from Rouen from Viking invasion. Rollo swore not to invade further Frankish lands himself. He accepted baptism and conversion to Christianity and swore fealty to King Charles III. Robert I of France stood as a godfather during Rollo's baptism. He became the first Duke of Normandy and Count of Rouen. The area corresponded to the northern part of present-day Upper Normandy down the River Seine, but the duchy would eventually extend west beyond the Seine. The territory was roughly equivalent to the old province of Rouen and reproduced the old Roman Empire's administrative structure. Before Rollo's arrival, however, Normandy's populations did not differ from Picardy or the Île-de-France, which were considered Frankish. Early Viking settlers had begun arriving in the 880s AD, but were divided between colonies in the east, around the Low Seine Valley, and in the west, towards the Cotlin Peninsula, and were separated by a traditional Pagi line, where the population remained about the same, with almost no foreign settlers. Rollo's contingents from Scandinavia, who raided and ultimately settled in Normandy and parts of the European Atlantic coast, included Danes, Norwegians, Norse Gaels, Orkney Vikings, possibly Swedes, and Anglo-Danes from the English Danelaw territory, which earlier came under Norse control in the late 9th century. The descendants of Vikings replaced the Norse religion and Old Norse language with Catholicism, and the language of the local people, descending from the Latin of the Romans. The Norman language, or Norman French, was forged by the adoption of the indigenous branch of the Romance by a Norse-speaking ruling class, and it developed into the French regional languages that survive today. Most Norman knights remained poor and land-hungry, and by the time of the expedition and invasion of England in 1066, Normandy had begun exporting fighting horsemen for more than a generation. Many Normans of Italy, France, and England eventually served as avid crusader soldiers under the Italo-Norman Prince Bohemund I of Antioch, and the Anglo-Norman King Richard the Lionheart, one of the most famous and illustrious kings of England. Now, we have already been over the invasion of England and 1066 in our narrative, so I don't really need to go over the life of Billy the Conk and his conquest of England, unless you're really interested to. If you are interested, though, in that, please head back a couple of episodes to where we went through his invasion. Instead, let's begin to touch upon the other exploits of the Norman people, with the Norman conquest of southern Italy. Viewed on the map, the Italian peninsula seems the most natural of locations for a single kingdom. or the secure heart of an empire as in Roman times. It was protected from mainland Europe by the Alps and on all other sides by the sea. In fact, its geographical position had precisely the opposite effect. Constantly nibbled at by neighbours, by the 9th century, Italy was crowded, an ever-shifting hodgepodge of rival petty states. The north was supposedly an integral part of the Holy Roman Empire, but Germany was the real basis of their kingship, and the king emperors rarely visited Italy except to be crowned. The south shared the remnants of the Justinian Byzantine holdings and the Lombard duchies. The only really stable element was actually the Papal State, running across the middle of the peninsula from Rome to Ravenna. Over the whole fell the shadow of the destructive raids by the pagan nomadic Magyars, or Hungarians from the north, and Muslim seaborne raiders up and down the coast from Sicily, which the Arabs had finally conquered in 902 AD, and went on to rule for a century and a half. All of the Mediterranean Europe had a complex relationship with the Arabs, who appeared to them as traders in fine eastern goods as often as freebooters. The 11th century signalled the end of Italy's darkest period. The Magyars were checked at the Battle of Lichfield in 955 AD. They then began to be Christianised. Under the Macedonian dynasty, the Byzantine Imperial Navy cleared the seas of Muslim pirates, and the Mediterranean trade steadily picked up. The revival of commerce led to the rebirth of the old Roman cities and established new ones. The period after 1000 AD was turbulent for the peninsula, even by Italian standards. In the north, the cities grew prosperous and insolent towards the meddling in their internal affairs, asserting their independence as city-states. In the southern Italy area, Byzantine power went into a sharp decline after the death of Emperor Basil II. With the Lombards, Muslim Germans and the papacy all trying to take advantage, but it was a group of newcomers who benefited the most from the chaos. Enter stage left, the Normans. The Norman conquest of southern Italy was very different from that of England. The latter was an organised military operation under the Duke of Normandy, while the former was achieved piecemeal by Norman adventurers from the lesser nobility. It is all the more remarkable for being largely the work of one family, that of a lone knight called Tancred, one of Normandy's more miserable villages. Almost nothing is known about Tancred himself, except that he had 12 sons, and not nearly enough of them an inheritance to go round. The family was no doubt aware of the opportunities for fighting men in southern Italy, since pilgrims from Normandy were regular visitors at the shrine to the Archangel Michael at Monte Gargano, the warrior saint that had special importance to the Normans. The first of the brothers to make his name in Italy was William. Norman missionaries had become coming to southern Italy in a small groups before the 1020s to offer their services to all sides, though the Lombards usually made the most generous employers. Having arrived in 1035, William first fought the Byzantines against the Muslims, then for the Lombards against the Byzantines, and by 1042 had carved out a small fiefdom for himself around Melf. At first, the locals struggled to welcome the Normans as liberators, but eager to escape the Byzantine tax collectors, they soon discovered the Normans were a good deal worse. They quickly gained a reputation for greed and brutality, a reputation they strove to live up to. Enemies surrounded to them more easily. Eventually, tales of Norman robbery, rape, murder reached the ears of the most powerful figure in Italy, and arguably Europe, the papacy. Only Pope Leo had the prestige to pull together an alliance from the scattered powers of Italy to drive off the troublesome Normans. Leo personally led the Allied army, but suffered a devastating defeat at the Battle of Civite in June 1053 AD, and he was captured. The pious Normans treated the Pope with every deference, but he was no less their prisoner. Norman religious fervour rarely got in the way of their driving ambition. Pope Leo was held for 9 months until he formally acknowledged the Normans' territorial holdings, later known as the Duchy of Aquila and Calabria. By now, it was clear that in the terms of brute strength and fighting ability, the Normans were without peer. All they lacked, however, was an effective leader. The Normans of Italy found just such a man in William's younger brother, Robert Guiscard. Having arrived in southern Italy in 1047 with just 35 men, Robert quickly displayed the cunning that would earn him the nickname the Fox. From his base at Scribia over the next 20 years, the Fox proved one of the most brilliant generals the Normans ever produced. With the Byzantine power in the midst of a spectacular decline, one town after another fell to the Fox, either submitting without a fight or falling prey to the clever ruses. In 1071, the Fox took Bari, the last Byzantine stronghold in Italy, permanently bringing to an end the presence of the Roman Empire on the Italian shores. By then, the Normans were already looking beyond the peninsula to Muslim Sicily. At the time, the Fatimid Sicily was ripe for conquest. Raked by civil war between Arab and Moorish elements of the army, the Fox first invaded Sicily in 1061, establishing a foothold in Messina and securing it by defeating a Muslim army at the Battle of Cremi at June 1063. But Sicily was a difficult island to conquer, and progress was slow and grueling. The great city of Palermo was besieged for the first time in 1064, but the Normans unknowingly made their camp on a hillside infested with tarantulas. The city fell eventually in 1072. Trapanani was in the hands by 1077, Cyprus was in 1086, and the last Muslim stronghold in Sicily, Noto, in February 1091 AD. Roger I, the first Norman ruler of Sicily, set the pattern that would characterise the island well into the 13th century. He had conquered the island for Latin Christianity, but continued the Muslim tradition of tolerance for all faiths. Latin Christians, Orthodox Christians, Muslims and Jews all found employment in his administration, as nowhere else in medieval Europe except Muslim Spain. The vitality of this multicultural melting pot is evident in the exquisite architecture of the peninsula in Palermo. The chapel harmoniously encapsulates a variety of styles. The walls are covered in bright mosaic in the Byzantine tradition. The vaulted ceiling carved and painted with the inscripted patterns in typical of Muslim design. And the sturdy round arches supporting the walls are from the Norman Romanesque architecture. Sicily became one of the most important centres of learning in Europe, producing such wonders as the Book of Roger, atlas with illustrious pictures and commentaries by the Arab geographer Muhammad al-Darasi. It contains such details as dual sources of the Nile, of Ghana, the caste system of India, and the rice cultivation in China, and remained the most accurate map of the world until the Age of Discovery. The map was commissioned by Roger II, who finally unified all Norman lands in southern Italy into a single kingdom. The Norman conquest had been a chaotic and unplanned affair, with different Normans establishing their own fiefdoms, both large and small, and constantly quarrelling among themselves. In wars between 1127 and 1144, Roger united all the Norman principalities and was recognised as its king by the Pope in 1130. This powerful kingdom, carved out by a few thousand Norman knights of lowly birth, would be a powerful example to the Crusaders of what could be achieved in the Holy Lands. We have gone over how the Normans invaded England. We have touched upon the Kingdom of Sicily and the impact the Normans had in Italy. What we have left out, however, are the future episodes of the Norman Crusaders. Now, we will go over them in the history of the First Crusade in our two-part episode that is in the pipeline to do when we reach that period of history in our tale. Second is really the more crucial one, Norman impact on Scotland. Well, for that, we are best off waiting for Malcolm's last surviving son to come to the throne, David I, as he will be instrumental in changing Scotland to a Norman Anglo-style kingdom. Now, since we have a few more years before David comes to the throne, I don't want to spoil anything here, but I will be making an episode where we go over David's changes to the Kingdom of Scotland. So, instead of this, should we dive into something more fun? Let's go into detail on the Norman warrior knight. Let me tell you, these guys are the real deal when it comes to that famous image of the medieval horseback knights riding into battle. So, to begin with, let's start off with a different device, their lance. Medieval knights have an importance of swords, both from the symbolic perspective and its association as an instrument of status. However, the weapon that truly transformed the knights, especially the Norman knights, into a battlefield force to be reckoned with was the lance. But what exactly is a lance, especially in its historical context? In simple terms, from the 10th to the 11th century, the lance wielded by a Norman knight generally composed of a straightforward stout spear, with its plain ash shaft fitted with a leaf-shaped iron head and a pretty long socket. In essence, the weapon form harkened back to the contus-type spear used by the heavy cavalry of the ancient times and late antiquity, like the famed companions of Alexander and the renowned heavy cavalry of Persia. Now, what is intriguing, which comes from the Bayeux tapestry, shows how many Norman knights held their lance overhead, which might be interpreted as a stabbing action. However, in few cases, the spear is shown as being thrown mid-air, thus suggesting the use of some sort of lance-like weapons or short spears as javelins from horseback. In any case, the status of the lance as a knight's weapon was mirrored by the ones fitted with tailored pennons that often carried forth the heraldry or symbols associated with the carrier, like the raven standards depicted in the Bayeux tapestry. Now, let's move on with squires. They were essentially knights in training, and thus by virtue were of noble birth. Historically states that the Norman knights also employed a large number of young men or non-noble origins as their attendants. As a matter of fact, many of these squires were actually paid in money. In any case, the job of a medieval squire was quite invaluable, with his foremost duty requiring him to carry the heavy burden of his master, the knight, including the luggage and the hefty weapons. He did this with the aid of a pack horse, or rouncy, and led the mighty deserter warhorse of his master through the routes. During times of campaign, the squire was charged with setting up the tent of the knight. At times, he also had to set forth a moment's notice for foraging and locating waterholes that would sate the logistical requirements of the heavily armoured and noble horsemen, but also burdened with the duty of dressing up the knights in their armour before the commencement of a battle. And since we brought up the scope of a battle, in spite of his position as a helper of the knight, the squire was expected to actively take part in military encounters, especially when the knight was dismounted and thus needed his reserved warhorse in the midst of the fray. Moreover, at times, few of the noble squires even put forth their claims to join the fight in protected siege battles, thus mirroring a bloody rite of passage pertaining to the future knighthood. Like most of their European counterparts, the Norman knights were basically chosen based on their lineage, and thus the 8 to 10 year old boys were sent to a lord's household to taking their training in combat, and most importantly following orders. Beyond the age of 14, many teenagers were inducted into the ranks of the squires, and finally by the age of 21 they were dubbed as knights. A seemingly odd initiation rite where the young man was given a hefty blow about the ears. He had to take on the blow without retaliating, thus symbolically suggesting that it was only physical blow after knighthood that he was going to willingly endure. These unmarried youths were the renowned knights errant of the numerous medieval songs and poems who supposedly followed the rigours of chivalry to seek fame, fortunes, and noble wives. In practical terms, many of the young men were retained as household knights, while the others piled their trade as mercenaries. Many of the younger sons, who had little chance of inheriting their predecessors' properties, tried their best to marry the rich heiresses whose patronage they lay claim to. Additionally, by the 11th century, the young Norman knights took part in tournaments that entailed free-form exercises like the French melee in open fields. These encounters almost played out like actual gruesome battles, with opposing team of knights fighting against each other in their full armour, while being armed with sharp weapons. The defeated knights, as a rule, had to forfeit their warhorse and rich armour, thus provided an incentive for many, a cash-stripped knight, for example, to win some prestige and, more importantly, armour and money. While these people were possibly inducted into a lord's household by the age of 10, a knight's real combat training only really started after the age of 12 or 13. One of the first exercises that the child teenager was taught entailed riding a horse, thus mirroring the contemporary remark, "He who has stayed at school till the age of 12 and never ridden a horse is fit only to be a priest." To that end, it was no easy task to maintain control over the imposing and mulish stallions, especially when manoeuvring had to be done with a shield on the left hand and a thrusting weapon like a lance in the right. Now, when riding the warhorse, the left hand was obviously used to hold the rein, but during the heat of combat, the shield had to be kept still, and hence the rein was often laid on the horse's neck, which suggests a delicate balancing act on part of the rider. And while the shield was an important part of the Norman knight's armour, it was the lance and its momentum that made these heavy horsemen truly effective on the battlefield. However, at times the sheer impact of the lance and its consequently shock could eventually dismount the knight in training from the horseback. Suffice to say, many practice runs resulted in serious injuries and even rare fatalities among the trainees. So over time, training was more focused on the optimized gripping of the lance that allowed the rider to stay on the horse after a successful charge. In that regard, the 14th century manuscripts depict particular constructs of wooden horses with wheels. The trainee was mounted atop the construct while his companions would pull the horse at full speed, hurling the rider towards a shield pinned along the post. The trainee had to aim for that shield with his lance, and the wooden horse continued to be dragged even after the impact was made, thus preparing the knight to brace after the momentum shock. Other training methods include sword cuts, parries, often with the help of wooden posts. And interestingly, harking back to the ancient Roman times, many of the blunt weapons used for training were often of double weight. This obviously allowed the knight to increase their stamina and fortitude of the trainees, which in turn compensated for their heavy gear in actual battle scenarios. The martial medieval Norman culture, partly inherited due to their Viking origins, was not just limited and often brutal to the training fields. Much like the near contemporary Mongols, the Norman military took particular pride in their hunting skills. The primal side of this scope was obviously related to gathering food. But as for the elite sections of Norman society, including the knights, hunting provided them with an opportunity to practice their horsemanship and endurance, especially on the rough terrains of the countryside. And on rare occasions, hunting was also the way one could showcase his courage and martial skill when the prey tended to be more dangerous, like a wild boar, a stag, or even a brown bear. To that end, Richard of Normandy, the second son of William the Conqueror, was possibly killed by a stag while hunting in the New Forest, a tract of heathland and woods that was proclaimed as a royal forest by William himself. Interestingly enough, by the later years, many of the Norman knights even practiced their archery skills on the quick prey, as the bow was raised to be being a prestigious weapon after the Norman conquest of England. As we mentioned at the beginning of this episode, the martial scope that differentiated the medieval Norman knight from the ordinary soldiers was directly related to the charge they could mount on a battlefield. And the Norman penchant for fast and brutal warfare was rather fueled by the tactical development and adoption of the couched lance, which was gripped firmly between the upper arm and chest. This allowed the knight to mount a forceful charge through the ranks of the enemy infantry, and it had a massive psychological impact on the imposing band of warhorses and their expert riders in this full armour and armament riding towards them in their greatest speed and momentum. This tactic for the medieval battlefield may seem simple and brutal, but as a Byzantine princess who infusively spoke of how the knights of the First Crusade could punch through the walls of Babylon with their devastating charge, this gives you an idea how people viewed it at the time. However, when it came to organising mass charges, much had to be done with discipline and training, which imparted in each of the Norman knights participating in the manoeuvre. For example, before mounting a charge, the group of heavy horsemen was assembled in numbers of 25 to 50, known as cronlons. These cronlons kept in formation very tight, so much that it was so said that even an apple could not pass through the gaps between the horses. Initially, the knights also kept their lances upright and their horses on a trot, as to not loosen the formation, and only on the final yards were the horses made to gallop and the lances put forward. Norman knights didn't really pertain to a particular group of soldiers with uniform bearing. Once again mirroring the social values of medieval Western Europe, the knights of the Norman origin were found in different walks of military, spread across various estates, fiefs, and even kingdoms. To that end, it was the eldest son who inherited the area and land that knight had on his dad, and thus continued the hereditary generations of landholding knightly class in the feudal society. But the options were not so clear for the younger sons, who either chose a military career or went for the path of monkhood. Considering the first choice, some opted to become vassals of the great lords. They were counted among the household knights and given prime parcels of lands around the lords' estates. In return, these knights held up the tradition of loyalty, one of the enduring legacies of ancient cultures such as the Celts and Germanic tribes. Others took the more diplomatic route, often settling down and making their fortune by marrying potentially rich heiresses. A few even went on to make their fortune through tournaments. In fact, one of Malcolm III's first sons with his first wife, as I told last time, Duncan, went over to the Norman side as he was part of the treaty between William the Conqueror and Malcolm III. He was taught and brought up with the Norman knight heritage, and he learnt to become a famous knight in the Norman capital of Rouen. And there he served under Robert Curtos and became quite a famous knight in that area before he came back to Scotland. Interestingly enough as well, in the initial years of the 11th century, a major percentage of Normans arriving in Sicily were actually employed as mercenaries by the Eastern Roman Byzantine Empire. Clearly, they did not learn of the fate of the main Roman Empire when they brought in mercenaries, and they clearly didn't learn their lesson. So I found that pretty funny. Interestingly enough as well, the Normans also established a long-standing yet transparent relationship with the papacy, as is evident from William the Conqueror's alliance with the Vatican. In that regard, many of the leaders of the church came from the Norman lords of the areas in and around France and England. Many of these church lands owed military service to the Norman overlords, and as such, resource-rich abbeys probably funded the first knights. So, that was the history of Normans. That was rather a long episode, and definitely a lot of information for you to digest. I know I broke the episode length rule, but it was worth breaking for the history of the Normans, wouldn't you agree? I would first like to apologise for ramming so much history into the episode, and also if I've mispronounced anything or told part of the story wrong, I do apologise for that as well. But I really wanted to dedicate an entire episode to the Norman people. Please give our early episodes a listen if you haven't, to learn more about the Norman conquest of England. And maybe if you're keen, give this episode a re-listen to make sure you didn't miss anything important. Now, yes, the history of the Normans definitely could be a podcast on its own, as there is so much to go over when it comes to them. They were fighters, leaders, great followers of the Christian faith who fought in the Holy Land, but they were also ruthless, strong-minded, and very prone to selfish exploits. I think without them, Europe and Scotland as a whole would be very different, and the impact they have left is certainly felt throughout the ages. Now, important note, if you are interested in learning more about Norman history, told in a much more fluid and concise way, I really would suggest giving Norman Centuries, a Norman history podcast by Lars Brownworth, a listen to. This podcast goes into great detail about the Norman history, and it also helped me write the script for today's episode. It really is a great series that goes in depth on Norman history. So that again is Norman Centuries, a Norman history podcast by Lars Brownworth. Or just type in Norman history podcast on Google, it'll be the first one. This is a must listen to podcast. Anyway, next week will be, spoiler, the death of the king, where we close the book on Malcolm III. We'll find out how he dies and what means for Scotland going forward. Will his death lead to Scotland being back into the depths of civil war with the inheritance? I think if you've been paying attention, you probably know the answer by now to that question. But let's hope it doesn't revert all the great changes Malcolm and Margaret have done for Scotland. Thank you again to everyone for the continued support on this series. If you haven't already, please go give our Twitter a follow, and please join our Facebook group, The History of Scotland, on Facebook. As always, any corrections or issues with the podcast, please let me know at thehistoryofscotlandpodcast@gmail.com. That is historyofscotlandpodcast@gmail.com. Please leave a review if you can, and as always, our podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, and many other great podcasting sites. Next podcast will be next week as always, so until then, stay safe, have a great week, and I'll catch you all on the next one. Peace, guys.